When you hear this, 500 combat hours and all these stories that you've continued to hear, what goes through your mind when you think about what he and his colleagues did?
Well, I'm just glad I didn't have to cross swords with Bud Anderson back in his youth and his prime. He was a considerable adversary for him to be able to survive the early days, the dark days in the war before it turned in our favor, and when we didn't have enough airplanes to go around and we were still learning how to make the guns fire all the time, and there was a lot of obstacles he had. For him to be able to survive that is not only because he had good maintenance and good parts and good people on the ground behind him, but he did an outstanding job in the air when the adversaries he faced.
What's the significance of the two words, Old Crow?
Gather that in so nobody trips over when they're leaving. Very good.
You want to whisper?
I have a prepared statement there for you.
Well, yeah.
Oh, well, I was afraid you'd go to ask that. I tell my non-drinking friends, my Baptist friends, that it's named after the most intelligent bird that flies in the sky, the crow. Well, that's true. The crow is a very canny bird. They've even been known to make tools to help them get food. And but my drinking buddies all know it's named after that good old Kentucky straight bourbon whiskey.
Bud, you're a group 357 fighter group. How successful was the fighter group compared to other groups?
Well, they had the heritage groups were already in England, the 4th and the 56, and they had already established a pretty good kill rate, but they couldn't go as far as we could go. They couldn't go all the way to the target and back. P-47s couldn't make it. P-38s could just barely make it with their tanks. And we could make it and go back again, you know, theoretically.
But in terms of kill rates?
Oh, yeah. We came into the war and early 45. These groups had been over there already flying since 1942, really. And our group was established a kill rate of, you know, how many kills you had a month for the first, for our duration, which was about 14 months. And it was higher than any other fighter group. But the kill rates of the 4th and the 56th were up there around 600, and we were just below 500, and well, just below 600. We were almost even with them, but we ended up being the third ranking group in the 8th Air Force.
No, I understand that your last, go ahead.
When we had 42 aces, and I think that's more than any fighter group over there.
We read that your group's 357th last mission shot down 57 and a half German airplanes. How many of those did you get?
It was my last mission.
Oh, your last mission. Your last.
But it wasn't the 357th last mission.
Your last mission.
God, you really come up with a... Well, as the story goes, Chuck Yeager, a young, eager flight officer, joined our unit when we were at Tonopah. And we became half-assed friends there. And he got shot down early in the war in March on a mission, and he escaped. He got with the Free French, and he finally got out to Spain. And he was supposed to be interned there for the remainder of the war. Well, I think our government made a deal with him and traded him for some gasoline to the Spanish people, and they released him, and he came back to Europe, came back to England. And he wanted to finish his tour. They said, no, you can't do that. If you've been shot down in the enemy territory and escaped, you don't go back there because you could be captured and tortured, and then you don't give up the secrets of the Free French and stuff like that. But he persisted, and after the invasion, he got up to as high as General Eisenhower, I think it was. And Ike said, well, it's your ass, son. If you want to, go ahead. So he's going to finish his first tour while I'm finishing I'm doing my second tour. And that's where our friendship began. We got into December, and he came by and he says, you know, let's finish our last mission together so we can go home together and maybe be assigned at the same place and continue our friendship. So I said, yeah, I can make that happen. I'm the operation officer. I'll know how to schedule it. So the day comes and closer, and he says, you know, it sure would be hell to get shot down on your last mission. And we had a couple like that. And one of the famous aces, Gabreski, was shot down on his last mission. And he says, I have a plan. He says, when our group goes out, when our squadron goes out, we always sent two spares behind. He says, unless you and I go as the spares, and if we don't have to fit into the, you know, if nobody aborts, nobody turns around for any reason whatsoever, let's go in with them, and nobody aborts, lets us go on a sightseeing mission down southern France and tour the Alps and all this kind of stuff. A beautiful country. We had, of course, seen it many times, but, you know, we'd never gone down there and really looked at it. So the day comes, 14th of January, 1945, and we're going down. Nobody aborts. Our group goes ahead. We make a 45, and we head south. And pretty soon we're flying along down there, and Jaeger's flying on my wing, I think. And he says, hey, there's Mount Blanc down there. Let's go down there and drop our tanks on it, strafe them, and see if we can set them on fire. Holy smokes. Well, I was a 22-year-old major, very responsible. Hey, that sounds like a good idea to me. So we dropped our tanks on it. And on the side of the mountain. This is the winter time. There's nobody up there. There were big glass plate structure up there at the top. But there's nobody on the side. It's in the winter anyway. So we drop our tanks and we strafed them and tried to set them on fire. But I don't think we did. Read Chuck's book and then read mine. But we shot our guns. That's important.
You told the truth in your book, right?
We shot our guns, and that put black stuff over the wings, and the tapes are gone, and everything. So then we go down sightseeing. We buzz the lakes and the hotels and all this stuff down here at the edge of Switzerland, and then head home on the deck. Northern France was still occupied. All the way home on the deck, and we're the last two guys home, and we buzz the field, which was customary for your last mission, and pitched out, came in and landed. And I'm taxied down. I turn down and I see Jaeger land, or he's already landed. He's taxied in behind me, and I got this real warm feeling about, oh man, I'm all done. I don't have to fly another combat mission and everything. And I just have a good feeling, and I pulled into my hard stand, and oh wow, I looked down there and there was all kinds of people standing in my hard stand. And I thought, oh, by the way, I'm the leading ace, you know, I'm the one that shot down all the most airplanes in the squadron. And I went, holy smokes, how'd they find out about this already, you know? And then I said, oh no, it's my last mission there. They'll pat me on the back. They don't even know. So I spun the tail around and shut it down. Otto jumps up on my wing and he says, Andy, he says, the group shot down 57 airplanes today. How many did you and Chuck get? That's the story of how Chuck Yeager and Bud Anderson missed the biggest air battle of World War II.
But jump ahead, would you? You come back from the war, you become a test pilot. And occasionally TDY go from Wright Pat out to Muroc, it was called then before it was changed to Edwards. What was Muroc like then? Why was it chosen to test airplanes there in the first place? And what was it like in the late 40s?
Well, Wright Field was the place to go. And that's where I went. But Muroc was there as an Army airfield. It hadn't been designated yet. We were still in the Army Air Corps. I mean, yeah, U.S. Army Air Corps. And they kept a field there because of a natural resource, this huge dry lake. I mean, you can, I forget the dimensions of it, but they're just incredible. It's when you have an emergency and you look down there and you think, I got to put it on that little 7,000 foot runway, which looks like a postage stamp compared to a dry lake. Well, oh hell, I can land anywhere, you know. And it's just the right place to do hazardous testing, first flights, things like that. So they had a base there so the contractors could come and do their, make first flight on their new vehicles and any kind of a hazardous testing they wanted to do. And then later all the X-planes landed on the lake bed, so they didn't have to be so precise. They could come in and land on the 15-mile runway rather than a 15,000-foot one. And with unlimited overruns. So it became a very special place to do flight testing.